We've reached the portion of our program that's devoted to our annual special feature, General Medicine 2013 Year in Review from NEJM Journal Watch Audio. With NEJM Journal Watch General Medicine Editor-in-Chief Dr. Alan Brett and Founding Editor Dr. Anthony Komaroff. Dr. Anthony Komaroff is a senior physician in the Division of General Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital and is a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, both in Boston, Massachusetts. Well, we always look forward to this edition, Tony, and especially to having you with us.
I always look forward to it too, Carol.
Dr. Alan Brett is the director of the Division of General Internal Medicine and is a professor of medicine at the University of South Carolina School of Medicine in Columbia, South Carolina. Alan, welcome back. We're so glad you're joining us again this year to share your views on the top medical stories of 2013.
It's a pleasure to be back, Tom. Every year, NEJM Journal Watch editors select a dozen or so topics that figured prominently in our coverage for the year. Some topics are represented by a single important clinical trial or a new guideline, and others are represented by several published studies on a single theme. We try to strike a balance between relevance to primary care, recognition of landmark trials, and media publicity and controversy. Speaking of controversy, Tony, let's start with a story that generated lots of heated discussion towards the end of 2013.
Alan, you're referring to two new and related guidelines issued in November, one on cardiovascular risk stratification, the other on cholesterol management. The National Institutes of Health handed off the updating of their old guidelines on these topics to the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology. So these new guidelines are intended to supersede the old risk calculator and treatment algorithm that we've used for so many years. The new risk stratification guideline gives us an updated risk calculator that's available online. You put in age, sex, and seven other variables, and you get the patient's 10-year risk for MI or stroke.
The other guideline, Tony, addresses lipid management. You determine whether the patient falls into one of four high-risk groups and then offer moderate or high-intensity statin therapy as defined by the authors without regard to reaching specific LDL targets. One treatment group consists of patients with known cardiovascular disease. The other groups encompass primary prevention in patients without known cardiovascular disease. Essentially, statin therapy is recommended for any patient with LDL over 190 and for any patient with LDL between 70 and 190 if there's either diabetes or 10-year risk over 7.5%. Lifestyle modification is, of course, recommended, and use of lipid-modifying drugs other than statins is discouraged. The authors acknowledge that some patients won't tolerate high-dose statins and that patient preferences should be considered, particularly in lower-risk primary prevention cases. But, Tony, these guidelines have already generated considerable controversy.
Yes, they have, Ellen. The new guidelines represent a paradigm shift by asking clinicians to suddenly abandon using specific LDL treatment targets. The rationale for this change is that clinical trials of statins didn't treat to targets. They picked patient populations and gave them fixed doses of statins or placebo. Another controversy concerns the risk calculator. One research group has already presented data suggesting that the new calculator overestimates risk substantially, by twofold in some cases. The concern is that the calculator would lead to unnecessary drug treatment for some patients.
Tony, many patients heard about these guidelines from media reports and are asking us what to make of them. One of my patients, a 70-year-old man with no risk factors, played with the online calculator on his own and found his risk to slightly exceed the 7.5% threshold. He asked me if that means he must take a statin. My suggestion for him, and patients generally, is to let the dust settle and not panic. As we hear more about the strengths and limitations of the guidelines, we'll hopefully learn how to apply them rationally.
Sounds reasonable to me. Alan, one of the most highly publicized studies of 2013 was the large Spanish trial that tested whether the so-called Mediterranean diet actually improves cardiovascular outcomes. As you know, this diet emphasizes olive oil, fruit, nuts, vegetables, and whole grain cereals, as well as moderate intake of fish, poultry, and wine with meals.
Tony, this randomized trial included 7,500 people with diabetes or multiple non-diabetes risk factors, but without clinically evident cardiovascular disease. There were two Mediterranean diet groups. One supplemented liberally with extra virgin olive oil, the other with a variety of nuts, and a control group that followed a low-fat diet. During 5 years of follow-up, the outcome of myocardial infarction, stroke, or cardiovascular death was modestly but statistically significantly lower in both Mediterranean diet groups compared to the control group. Roughly one adverse outcome was prevented for every 70 people on the Mediterranean diet. Most of the benefit was a reduction in stroke. Neither MI rates nor mortality were reduced significantly.
Because the low-fat control diet wasn't dramatically different from the Mediterranean diet, some observers believed that the supplemental olive oil and nuts were primarily responsible for these results. But many participants in each group were taking ACE inhibitors and statins, and 30% drank at least a glass of wine daily. These characteristics might have contributed to the relatively low rate of cardiovascular events in all groups.
Until now, Tony, most of the evidence favoring the Mediterranean diet was observational. We now have randomized trial-level evidence that this diet, along with a generous intake of extra virgin olive oil and nuts, does confer some cardiovascular benefit. Tony, I'll bet those direct-to-consumer ads for transdermal testosterone to treat so-called low T provoke more patient requests than ads for any other drug in primary care practice. We know very little about the long-term benefits and harms of testosterone therapy in men who have age-related declines in blood testosterone levels. But in a short-term randomized trial published 3 years ago, testosterone therapy increased the incidence of adverse cardiovascular events in older men with comorbidities.
That's right, Alan. And this past year, we had another hint of possible trouble with testosterone. Researchers published a large retrospective study of about 9,000 men with coronary disease risk factors who had total testosterone levels less than 300 nanograms per deciliter. During an average follow-up of 2 years, men who were given testosterone therapy had a significantly higher risk of MI, stroke, or death than men who weren't prescribed testosterone. Although the study was retrospective, they controlled for confounding variables, and the results were consistent with the previous randomized trial you just mentioned.
One of the reasons men request testosterone is to improve erectile function. In a study published at the end of 2012, 140 middle-aged men with erectile dysfunction and testosterone levels below 330 received optimized treatment with sildenafil, trade name Viagra, and then were randomized to add daily transdermal testosterone or placebo. Erectile function improved with sildenafil, but add-on testosterone led to no further improvement, even in those with baseline levels below 250.
We clearly need a large, long-term, controlled trial of testosterone therapy, similar to the Women's Health Initiative studies of estrogen replacement. But such a trial is unlikely. For now, we need to educate patients that moderate age-related declines in blood testosterone are the norm, that testosterone therapy will not miraculously improve energy levels or erectile function, and that transdermal testosterone is a drug with potential adverse effects.
Randomized trials in critically ill patients have demonstrated better outcomes with a restrictive approach to red cell transfusion, but patients with acute gastrointestinal bleeding were not included in those studies. Transfusion for massive GI bleeding can be life-saving, but the value of transfusion for lesser bleeding has been unclear. This gap in the literature was filled by a study from Spain that included 900 patients with non-massive acute GI bleeding, mostly from ulcers or esophageal varices, and a low risk for rebleeding.
That's right, Alan. Patients were randomized to a restrictive strategy with transfusion triggered by a hemoglobin less than 7, or a liberal strategy with transfusion triggered by a hemoglobin less than 9. About half of the restrictive strategy group eventually received transfusions, compared with nearly everyone in the liberal strategy group. At 45 days, mortality was significantly lower in the restrictive strategy group than in the liberally transfused group, 5 versus 9%, and rebleeding also occurred less often with the restrictive strategy. The benefit of restricting transfusions was seen mainly in patients with cirrhosis, possibly because transfusions raise portal pressure.
Tony, we assume that restoring normal physiology should be beneficial, but this study is a good example that it can sometimes cause harm. Although this study obviously couldn't be blinded, it was well done and should influence practice. Both the reduced use of blood products and the clinical benefits are substantial.
Several important trials that addressed early stroke treatment were published in 2013. Let's start with two studies that examined blood pressure management.
Sure, Tony. Whether hypertension should be treated during the first day or two in patients with ischemic stroke is controversial. The concern is that early blood pressure lowering will worsen outcomes through hypoperfusion of the ischemic area. Guidelines recommend treatment only when blood pressure exceeds 220 over 120, unless a patient will be getting thrombolytic therapy. In 2013, the first large randomized trial to examine this issue was published. Nearly 5,000 Chinese patients with ischemic stroke received either early antihypertensive therapy to a target of 140 over 90 or no treatment. The findings were straightforward, no benefit and no harm for the endpoint of death or major disability.
Another randomized trial looked at hemorrhagic stroke, where guidelines do recommend acute blood pressure lowering to less than 160 over 90 to minimize hematoma expansion. About 3,000 patients with hemorrhagic stroke and systolic pressure between 150 and 220 were treated to a target of either 180 or 140. The outcome was a close call. There was a statistically borderline lower rate of death or major disability in the intensive treatment group, 52 versus 56%.
Tony, now let's turn to antiplatelet therapy. Standard treatment of ischemic stroke or TIA includes early aspirin. To determine whether dual antiplatelet therapy might be better than aspirin alone, Chinese researchers conducted a randomized trial involving 5,000 patients with a high-risk TIA or minor ischemic stroke. Starting within 24 hours, one group received daily aspirin alone. The other group received aspirin plus clopidogrel for 3 weeks, followed by clopidogrel alone. At 3 months, the incidence of new stroke was significantly lower in the dual therapy group, 8 versus 12%, without any increase in bleeding complications. Although this study makes a compelling case for dual antiplatelet therapy, an ongoing trial from the United States will determine whether the findings can be extrapolated to a Western population.
Finally, Alan, endovascular interventions, such as intra-arterial tPA or mechanical clot disruption or retrieval, have been used increasingly in acute stroke. But in three randomized trials published in 2013, endovascular interventions weren't superior to standard treatments in patients with mainly anterior circulation strokes.
So, with three take-home points, let's summarize what these new trials tell us about stroke treatment during the first 24 hours. First, consider dual antiplatelet therapy for patients with minor ischemic stroke or TIA. Second, in patients with substantial hypertension, moderate blood pressure lowering is neither beneficial nor harmful for ischemic stroke, but may be beneficial for hemorrhagic stroke. And third, the efficacy of endovascular interventions for anterior circulation strokes remains unproven. Let's now turn to endovascular intervention elsewhere, in the renal artery. In theory, stenting for hypertensive patients with atherosclerotic renal artery stenosis seems like an obvious way to lower blood pressure and preserve renal function. But several years ago, two randomized trials failed to show that renal artery stenting was beneficial. One criticism of the earlier studies was that they included some patients who didn't have clinically important renal artery stenosis. In 2013, the CORAL study addressed this criticism.
That's right, Alan. This study included nearly 1,000 patients with atherosclerotic renal artery stenosis of at least 60% and either resistant hypertension or chronic kidney disease. Patients were randomized to optimal medical therapy alone or medical therapy with stenting. At about 3.5 years of follow-up, there was no significant difference between the two groups for a variety of cardiovascular and renal outcomes, or for a composite of all adverse outcomes. Not a single subgroup benefited from stenting, including patients with the highest blood pressures or those with stenoses greater than 80%.
Tony, the results of this trial, combined with the two previous ones, should close the door on this debate. Patients who have moderate to severe atherosclerotic renal artery stenosis and resistant hypertension or chronic kidney disease don't benefit from stenting. They should receive optimal medical therapy only.
Several important intensive care unit studies were published in general medical journals in 2013, and we're going to discuss two of them here. Alan, tell us about the first one, which involved mechanical ventilation for acute respiratory distress syndrome, or ARDS.
Sure, Tony. Because patients with ARDS often develop consolidation in dependent lung regions, some physicians turn severely hypoxemic patients from supine to prone positions to improve aeration of these areas. To examine this practice, researchers randomized nearly 500 mechanically ventilated patients with moderate to severe ARDS to prone positioning for an average of 17 hours a day or to usual supine positioning. 1 month mortality was significantly lower in the prone group than in the supine group. It was 16 versus 33%. Although proning isn't suitable for all ARDS patients, it should be considered early for patients with severe disease.
The second study, Alan, looked at the common practice of monitoring gastric residuals in mechanically ventilated patients who receive nasogastric tube feedings. This is done because it's assumed that large residuals predispose to vomiting, aspiration, and ventilator-associated pneumonia. To examine this practice, researchers randomized 450 mechanically ventilated patients to gastric residual monitoring every 6 hours or to no monitoring. Residual volume above 250 milliliters in the monitored group triggered treatment with a prokinetic drug and a decrease in tube feeding rates. Although the monitored group had less vomiting, there were no differences between the two groups in the incidence of ventilator-associated pneumonia, length of stay, or mortality, and non-monitored patients were more likely to reach calorie goals.
Tony, our NEJM Journal Watch intensivist consultant believes that both of these studies should be considered practice-changing. To summarize, proning appears to save lives, and monitoring gastric residuals in tube-fed patients adds to the work of bedside nurses without improving outcomes.
Although there's good evidence that systemic steroid therapy improves outcomes in patients with acute exacerbations of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, the optimal duration of treatment hasn't been clear. The 2013 guideline from the Global Initiative for Chronic Obstructive Lung Disease, the so-called GOLD guideline, recommends that we treat COPD exacerbations with 30 to 40 milligrams of prednisone daily for 10 to 14 days, but the guideline notes a lack of good data on duration of therapy.
Fortunately, Tony, we now have a clinical trial that addresses this issue. The study included 300 patients with COPD who presented to the emergency department with exacerbations, nearly all of which required hospital admission. The patients were randomized to receive either 5 or 14 days of oral prednisone at a dose of 40 milligrams a day, along with other standard interventions. It turned out that all outcomes were just as good in the 5-day group as in the 14-day group, including need for mechanical ventilation, symptom scores, mortality, and time to next exacerbation. It's important to note that most of these patients had a history of moderate to severe COPD, so the short course approach should be broadly applicable.
It's likely, Alan, that the next set of guidelines will recommend a 5-day course of 40 milligrams a day of prednisone for patients with COPD exacerbations based on this trial. Since patients often have several exacerbations annually, this approach could substantially reduce overall steroid exposure and steroid side effects in COPD patients. For quite a while now, researchers have been intrigued by the idea of dual blockade of the renin-angiotensin system using combinations of ACE inhibitors, angiotensin receptor blockers, and most recently, direct renin inhibitors. Dual blockade does lower blood pressure and reduce proteinuria more than monotherapy. But so far, there's no evidence that dual therapy improves morbidity and mortality. In 2013, a flurry of studies essentially killed the idea of dual blockade.
That's right, Tony. Three randomized trials involved a total of 10,000 patients with type 2 diabetes and covered a spectrum of renal function and proteinuria. Two trials compared an ACE inhibitor plus an ARB with either drug alone, and a third trial examined the addition of the renin inhibitor alisgiron to either an ACE inhibitor or an ARB. Taken together, these trials showed that dual therapy improved no cardiovascular or renal outcomes while causing an increase in adverse events.
In another trial, Alan, 1,600 patients with systolic heart failure who were taking ACE inhibitors or ARBs were given alisgiron or placebo. Again, there was no improvement in cardiac outcomes, and adverse events were more common with dual therapy.
And finally, Tony, on top of all this, a meta-analysis was published that covered fully 33 randomized trials comparing dual blockade and monotherapy, with the same negative results as the individual trials we've just discussed. So the bottom line from 2013, don't use dual therapy to block the renin-angiotensin system. In July of 2013, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force issued a preliminary draft statement recommending lung cancer screening with low-dose computed tomography. And just yesterday, a final recommendation in favor of screening was officially released. I might add that the American College of Chest Physicians also recommended CT screening this past year.
Alan, the task force recommendation is for annual screening with low-dose CT in people between the ages of 55 and 79 with smoking histories of at least 30 pack years. This recommendation is based on the entry criteria to the randomized National Lung Screening Trial, in which three annual screening CTs reduced lung cancer mortality from roughly 1.6 to 1.3% during 6 years of follow-up. But for every death prevented, 320 people had to be screened, and the false positive rate was high. In the first round of screening alone, about 30% of patients had at least one abnormality, very few of which represented lung cancer.
Two important prediction models with relevance to the false positive problem and developed from large cohorts of patients were published in 2013. One model showed that screening the lowest risk people eligible by task force criteria would save no lives but would still cause harms from false positive results. This suggests that we could narrow the eligibility criteria for screening while retaining the overall mortality benefit. The other model indicates the probability that a pulmonary nodule found in a smoker who undergoes CT screening will be diagnosed as malignant during 3 years of follow-up. Knowing this probability could help us choose between follow-up imaging, immediate biopsy, or no further intervention. This risk calculator is available online.
In the end, Alan, the benefits of screening will outweigh harms only if patients are selected carefully for screening and if screen-positive patients are managed in high-quality centers where unnecessary invasive procedures are avoided.
Electronic cigarettes, cigarette-shaped battery-powered nicotine vapor delivery devices, have generated lots of controversy during the past year. Some people promote e-cigarettes as smoking cessation aids, but we know little about their risks and benefits.
Alan, studies published in 2013 illustrated how rapidly e-cigarettes are growing in popularity. One survey showed that between 2011 and 2012, use of e-cigarettes doubled from 1.5% to 3% among middle school students and from 5% to 10% among high school students. Most of these kids also smoked conventional cigarettes. Surveys showed that adult use of e-cigarettes also increased dramatically during the past few years.
A randomized trial from New Zealand examined e-cigarettes as smoking cessation aids. Nearly 700 adult smokers who wished to quit received daily nicotine patches, ad-lib use of nicotine-containing e-cigarettes, or ad-lib use of placebo-containing e-cigarettes for 3 months. At 6 months, all three groups had similar low abstinence rates, around 5%, although the average duration of abstinence was higher in the nicotine e-cigarette group than in the other two groups, about 5 versus 2 weeks.
Many questions about e-cigarettes remain unanswered, Alan. Aside from addiction, what risks are incurred from inhaling nicotine vapor, particularly in children? What other harmful substances might be present in e-cigarettes? Can non-users be harmed by secondhand vapor? Will e-cigarettes aid in smoking cessation, or will they encourage smoking and undermine anti-smoking campaigns, particularly in kids?
Well, Tony, it's sort of cliché to end a discussion by saying more research is needed, and that's why we usually avoid that line. But in this case, we absolutely need data to answer the important questions that you just posed in order to inform public policy on electronic cigarettes. Before we conclude, I want to mention that a few days ago, as we were putting this feature together, the long-awaited JNC8 hypertension guideline was published. We'll be discussing it in the January 15, 2014 issue of Journal Watch.
On that subject, Alan, and many others, there's plenty more to come in 2014. Happy New Year, Alan.
And Happy New Year to you, Tony.